absolute. And verse number 2, and I'll just do the Sanskrit and translation and the purport. Name vidu suragana prabhavam namaharshaya ahamadirhi devanam maharshinam chasarvashaha. Translation. Neither the hosts of demigods nor the great sages know my origin or opulences, for in every respect I am the source of the demigods and sages. Purport. As stated in the Brahma Samhita, Lord Krishna is the Supreme Lord. No one is greater than him. He is the cause of all causes. Here it is also stated by the Lord personally that he is the cause of all the demigods and sages. Even the demigods and great sages cannot understand Krishna. They can understand neither his name nor his personality. So what is the position of the so-called scholars of this tiny planet? No one can understand why this supreme God comes to earth as an ordinary human being and executes such wonderful, uncommon activities. One should know then that scholarship is not the qualification necessary to understand Krishna. Even the demigods and the great sages have tried to understand Krishna by their mental speculation, and they have failed to do so. In the Srimad Bhagavatam also it is clearly said that even the great demigods are not able to understand the Supreme Personality of Godhead. They can speculate to the limit of their imperfect senses and can reach the opposite conclusion of impersonalism, of something not manifested by the three qualities of material nature, or they can imagine something by mental speculation. But it is not possible to understand Krishna by such foolish speculation. Here the Lord indirectly says that if anyone wants to know the absolute truth, here I am present as the Supreme Personality of Godhead. I am the Supreme. One should know this. Although one cannot understand the inconceivable Lord who is personally present, he nonetheless exists. We can actually understand Krishna, who is eternal, full of bliss and knowledge, simply by studying his words in the Bhagavad Gita and Srimad Bhagavatam. The conception of God as some ruling power or as the impersonal Brahman can be reached by persons who are in the inferior energy of the Lord. But the personality of Godhead cannot be conceived unless one is in the transcendental position. Because most men cannot understand Krishna in his actual situation, out of his causeless mercy, he descends to show favor to such speculators. Yet despite the Supreme Lord's uncommon activities, these speculators, due to contamination in the material energy, still think that the impersonal Brahman is the Supreme. Only the devotees who are fully surrendered unto the Supreme Lord can understand by the grace of the Supreme Personality that he is Krishna. The devotees of the Lord do not bother about the impersonal Brahman conception of God. Their faith and devotion bring them to surrender immediately unto the Supreme Lord, and out of the causeless mercy of Krishna, they can understand Krishna. No one else can understand him. So even great sages agree, what is Atma? What is the Supreme? It is he whom we have to worship. Omagyana timirandhasya gyananjana shalakaya chakshurun militam yena tasmai shri gurave namaha. So the spiritual master opens our eyes with a torchlight of knowledge. We who are immersed in ignorance in this material energy, governed by the three modes of material nature of goodness, passion, and ignorance. So in the Srimad Bhagavatam, in the first canto, in the first verse, Srila Prabhupada in the purport explains that it's natural that a philosophical mind, an inquiring mind, wants to know about the origin of creation. You know, at at night, a person sees the stars in the sky, and he naturally speculates who is living there, what kind of a situation is there in the stars. And such inquiries, he says, are natural for man, because man has developed a consciousness that is higher than the animals. He has a developed consciousness. So the author of the Srimad Bhagavatam, he gives a direct answer to all these questions. He says that Lord Sri Krishna is the origin of all creation. And this is also, as it's said in the purport, reflected in the Brahma Samhita, the prayer of Lord Brahma, who is the first created being of this universe, where he says, Ishvara Parama Krishna Satchid Ananda Vigraha Anadir Adir Govindam Sarvakarana Karanam. So this translation is, the supreme controller, the supreme Ishvara, is Krishna, Satchid Ananda Vigraha. He has a form composed of Sat, which is eternality, Chit, which is all full knowledge, and Anand, which is supreme bliss. His form is that. And that Anadir Adir Govindam, he is without beginning, he is without end, he is without birth, he is eternal in that sense, Anadir. Adi means first, the first thing. He is Anadi also. He is beyond simply the first being. He is eternally. And Sarva Karana Karanam, that of all the causes, he is the cause. So sometimes people will ask, you know, well, who created the planets? And you say, well, God created the planets. Then they will ask, well, who created God? And we say, no. That is where the buck stops. That is where the end is, that he has created them and he is eternal and he is the supreme and the controller. And that is the definition of God. So it is not simply a question that that there is someone beyond that, as because many people, they think that this material universe, it is in and of itself eternal, and things are just moving and migrating within this universe. Stars evolve and stars are destroyed, and in this way that the universe is actually God. There are many people who feel that these forces of nature are actually God. That is their highest conception. It says here that in that purport, in the first canto, that there are atheists of various categories who do not believe in a creator. And this, the Srimad Bhagavat explains, is due to their poor fund of knowledge. That simply because they do not understand, simply because they have not seen or speculated on the existence of a creator, therefore they say there cannot be a creator. So this is roughly like, we call this the head in the sand philosophy, that you know, the ostrich is thinking, oh, the lion is coming. If I bury my head in the sand, then I'm free from the lion. But that is not the reality, because he will very soon be eaten by the lion if he maintains this position. So we continue now. That I remember reading, this was about, I don't know, 8 or 9 years ago, Scientific American. There's a magazine called Scientific American. And so it had on the cover, it was a big white cover, Scientific American, and they had this picture of about an inch in diameter, a marble, like a reddish blob. And they explained on the cover that this was the size of the universe 1 millisecond after the Big Bang, right? So this was their conception, that the universe is created from some Big Bang. So I was thinking about this, and it's, how do they understand what exactly in their terminology is the Big Bang? See? So we have to see that their terminology is math and physics. So they have a vast number of formulas to explain how from something the size of this marble would attain the size of this massive universe. And so there are various formulas and speculations and scientific mathematic formulas by which they derive this understanding. And similarly, actually, we also have our formulas and our understanding of how the universe is created. And this understanding is developed in the Vedic literature, in the various mantras and the various explanations of the great sages. So I was just hearing a class or reading how one devotee was questioning Srila Prabhupada, and he said to Srila Prabhupada, "You know, the scientists, you are calling your philosophy a science, you see. But the scientists will say, well, how can you do such a thing? Because at least with our science, we can prove certain things by formulas, by mathematics, by experimentation. We prove that certain things are there." So Srila Prabhupada said, yes. And in the Bhagavad Gita, we have proofs of the universe, that this universe is expanding, that this universe is destroyed, things are destroyed and created, and we accept, because the Bhagavad Gita and the Srimad Bhagavatam, they also have their proofs, have their truth. So your science and our science, they're not so different. But, and so this is, when, so then, so in this story of the marble, one of the things that the scientists said at the time was that the universe was 4.5 billion years old. See, that was their understanding, because they had extracted this from their various formulas of how big the marble was and how big the universe is, and therefore it would have taken so long for the universe to expand. It would have taken 4.5 billion years for the universe to expand to such a size. So this is their proposition. However, just recently, because they shot this telescope into outer space, right, the Hubble telescope. So now they've decided that the universe is actually much bigger. It has 100 billion galaxies, and each galaxy contains 100 billion stars. That is their current. And now they're saying that actually the universe is 13.7 billion years old. It has expanded. Their whole time frame has expanded. And this is what Srila Prabhupada explains. This is due to their poor fund of knowledge, that they're not understanding, they cannot understand truly the reality of this universe, because their senses and their means of understanding are so limited. So, and then further along in the Srimad Bhagavatam, Maharaj Parikshit asks Shukadev Goswami virtually the same question. He asks, "I beg to know from you how the personality of Godhead, by his personal energies, creates these phenomenal universes as they are, which are inconceivable even to the great demigods." So these universes, Maharaj Parikshit, from this verse, he understands that Krishna is the origin from the first verse. So now he's asking, oh, all right, now I know the origin of the universe, but what are the mechanisms by which the universe is now created? How does he actually? And again, in the purport, Srila Prabhupada points out that that this is the natural inclination of human beings, is to find out where we are from and how we got here and where we're going. And for that, Srila Prabhupada explains that Parikshit Maharaj, he has approached the proper authority. He has approached a spiritual master who actually knows what is the situation of this material world and what is the situation of the spiritual world. And therefore, he's the proper authority to ask to answer this question. Now, there's a nice explanation in the teachings of Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur. He gives a very nice explanation of what exactly is the situation for the conditioned soul and for the realized soul. And what he says, again, is that... here it is. The soul has four particular features, right? The soul is spiritual knowledge personified. And again, to go back to the verse in the Brahma Samhita, he said, it is Sat Chit Ananda. The second quality is Chit, and which is knowledge. And this is its natural feature. So it's not that because... Well, I'll get to the situation of the material energy. So he says the soul has spiritual knowledge itself. It has consciousness of being. In other words, the soul understands that I am, that I have my own distinct personality, my own distinct being, you could say. He says the soul is filled with light, and this light can illuminate the features of other things. So the soul knows both itself and it knows other things, whatever exists. So that's the third feature. And the soul, furthermore, has all power to see, taste, touch, feel, and all the various senses. So these are the natural inclinations, the natural constitution of the soul. When we talk about constitution, we think of the United States. It has a constitution. So what is that that constitution is all the laws and all the prescriptions that control the government. This is the constitution, and without this constitution, the United States doesn't exist. In one sense, you can say it's the constitution is actually a figment of their imagination, because the physical reality does not necessarily reflect what the Constitution says. Anyway, that's a whole other topic which we won't get into. But the constitution of the spirit soul is important to know, that it has this full knowledge. And then Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur, he explains that when the soul falls into this material world, it is imprisoned within material coverings. And to enable the soul to interact with the material world, he is given a second set of senses. He says these material senses enable him to interact with the material world. So you get those senses, and these senses are very limited and very imperfect. So for example, we know... just the scientists will tell us, and we can see from their experiments, there are things like infrared light, there are things like above sonic sound, there are all kinds of areas of sensual perception which we don't understand. Dogs have a much higher understanding of hearing. They can hear at much higher levels than we can. Other animals have different sense of smell, different sense of vision, for example. Prabhupada gives the explanation, for example, that an eagle will see a prey, you know, miles away. For us, it is a small, insignificant dot, but the eagle can see, oh, that's a rabbit, and it's waiting to get caught, you know. So that his sense of vision is so much greater than ours. And in this way, Bhaktivinoda Thakur explains that we're covered by these material senses that are very imperfect. And this is, he describes it in this way. He says, this is a great calamity for the spirit soul. This is a very unfortunate thing that happens to the spirit soul when he comes to this material world. So then he says that the solution is for the soul to become liberated by the instruction of souls who are not covered by these illusions. He says the liberated and self-realized living beings, they can answer the questions of material life, you know. And pure liberated souls do not give a great variety of answers. If you look at philosophy as it has come through, the different ages, and Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur points out that in different countries there are different philosophies about the origins of life and the nature of human beings. You know, there's the Chinese have philosophies, the Greeks had philosophies, the Romans had philosophies, the British have philosophies, all these different philosophers to try to explain what is progress for the human being. How can the human being actually attain perfection? You know, what is his nature? And these philosophies arise because there are different material modes of nature happening in these different countries and different times and situations. So, but he says that self-realized souls do not have a difference of philosophy. There is only the absolute truth for the self-realized soul. And that absolute truth is unchanging and unvarying and is not dependent on time, place, and circumstance. So these are some of the realizations of actually Bhaktivinoda Thakur, who is one of the self-realized souls. So now there's another, to go back to the scientific analysis. Srila Prabhupada, before coming to the United States, he wrote a book called Easy Journey to Other Planets, in which he described that the Nobel Prize had just been given to some Russian scientists who had discovered what they called antimatter. See? And they said that this antimatter could explain certain phenomena in the universe that were not explainable previously. See? And over and above that, he said that they won the Nobel Prize for this antimatter. And now the scientists have discovered that there is yet another phenomenon which they call dark matter. And so antimatter, they reckon now, is the universe is 23% of the universe is composed of antimatter, right? And then they say 72% of the universe is composed of dark matter. So that's the equivalent. So 95% of the universe, as they see it, according to their formulas and their physics and mathematics, 95% of the universe is composed of antimatter and dark matter, and only 5% of the universe is what we would call reality, which we see and taste and touch and feel. And they have ascribed the property of dark matter, that dark matter is what creates gravity. Because gravity is a big problem. We don't see gravity, but we feel it at every moment. Because we know the Earth is spinning around, why don't the things fly off? Normally, they should just go some, you know, they should just by momentum be swept away into the universe, but they aren't. And so they're saying now this dark matter is what actually causes gravity. And we understand that in the Bhagavad Gita, it's described that this matter is called kam. This kam we've translated as ether. That is a subtle element, and that sound projects through ether. Now, normally, we think of sound. Sound is actually, we understand, a vibration in the air. See, so sound vibrates in the air, and if we're close enough, we can hear the vibration, and we understand that is sound. But in outer space, and the scientists, when they take their rockets into outer space, they broadcast back to the Earth, you know, so they're by radio waves. So, but there's no air in space. So what are those radio waves riding on? So they finally understand, okay, this is what is the explanation of dark matter or antimatter and these things, that we're getting these communications from space due to this. And we understand that in the Bhagavad Gita, this is called ether. And the Bhagavad Gita and the Vedic literature actually describes the elements in a different way. The scientists, they will examine a piece of wood or stone or whatever, and they'll get the microscope and they'll try to enter into that kind of matter and try to find out exactly what it is through the microscope or through their instruments, their scientific instruments. And therefore they come to the conclusion that gold has this elemental property, copper has this elementary property, sand has this, and so on and so forth, and all these different elements are there in their elementary tables. But we as living entities, we don't experience matter naturally in that way. We experience it according to our senses, according to sight, sound, touch, taste, feel. These are the senses, the knowledge acquiring and knowledge gathering senses. So the Vedic literature looks at these different elements as how they interact with those senses. So we see there are earth, water, fire, air, ether. There are solids, there are liquids, there are gases. This is how we, from the inside, understand the material elements. And that is the difference between the scientific approach and the Vedic approach. The approach of the yogi who goes within to try to explain what is inside, what the true reality is of his nature, and understands that the outer senses, these knowledge acquiring senses, they are simply what you might call a temporary and imperfect manifestation, just to allow us to get along in this material world, because that's all we can hope to do in this material world. Will never be a utopia. It will never be the Garden of Eden. It will never be the land of milk and honey. These heavenly ideas, this idea of utopia for this material world is illusion. And so we are confined and trapped in this space with these bizarre speculations as to who and what we are and what this material world is supposed to be. So we understand that to come closer to the Supreme Personality of Godhead, there are certain formulas. There are our scientific formulas are very simple and very easy to understand. By the chanting of the Lord's holy name, by the taking of prasadam, and by the association of great sages, where we can at least, through their knowledge, understand what indeed is the Supreme Personality of Godhead and what is our relationship with Him. Because that relationship, that is the goal of our life, the true goal of our life. There's a nice description that Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur gives of that most people are attracted to the opulence of God. They think that God is the wealthiest, God is the greatest, God is... But we as devotees understand that actually God is the sweetest. And you can understand the sweetness of God is actually in direct opposition to the opulence of God. That the less you care for the opulence of God, the more you will acquire a taste for the sweetness of God. And so that is our prayer as devotees, that we can understand this facet, this understanding of the spiritual world. So it's getting a little on, and we'd like to know, are there any questions? Wait, yes, Prabhu. Yes. Yes. Right. 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 Before the universe existed. Yeah. Yeah. So that's a good logical point. Yeah, that's a good logical point, is that their theory is that before the Big Bang there was nothing. Now this is illogical, on the face of it totally illogical, because we don't see anywhere in the material world that something comes from nothing. Always something comes from something. It's not logical. So by their own admission, they're arguing an illogical or premise. And for them to speculate that before this universe that nothing existed, therefore no living entities existed, and now they're stuck with these living entities and trying to explain how they arose from nothing. But I know, but that's the logical point that it comes to. Yes. Right. Yeah. 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 Right. Yeah. Right. Yeah. Yes. They should. They should indeed. Yeah. Jai, you want to? So that's also a very nice story of the frog in the well. So the frog is sitting in his well, and a friendly frog who has left the well comes back and tells this frog that, you know, I saw the ocean. You know, this ocean is really amazing. It's such a huge body of water. So the frog says, well, wow, really, you know, is it twice the size of my... Oh, no, it's much, much bigger. Oh, three times. No. And the frog is puffing himself up. No, it must be how much bigger? And eventually the frog himself explodes because, it's just not possible for him to understand the nature of the ocean from his tiny well. And actually, there's Plato, the Greek philosopher, he also had a description of this world. He said, this world is like, if you can imagine, there are some people that are chained inside a cave. And they're chained so that they're looking at the wall of the cave. And behind them is the opening of the cave. And the light is streaming into the opening of the cave. And occasionally there are shadows and light and reflections of the light that are projected onto the wall of the cave that they're looking at. And they try to speculate what caused the different shadows and the different lights and the different things. And he said, that is a description of who we are in this material world, trying to understand the absolute truth and trying to understand the real nature of the world. And so that was Plato's description. He had certain things quite right, Plato. He missed a few things, but he was close. What are the other analogies? I can't think right now. The other one is that people trying to describe the nature of God or the nature of the universe are like blind men who approach an elephant and they try to understand. The one is grabbing the leg of the elephant and he's saying, oh, an elephant is like this big round tree, you know, kind of thing. And the other one's grabbing the tail of the elephant, and to him the elephant is something else. And the other one is, you know, feeling the skin of the elephant. Oh, the elephant is a rough skin kind of thing, you know. But actually, the analogy that I take from that, which would be much better, I think, would be if you were an ant looking at the elephant and trying to describe what an elephant is. You know, a blind ant, you know, just by feel, trying to figure out what an elephant is. That's really the nature of scientific discovery as we know it. So, thank you all very much. Hare Krishna.